This meeting will come to order. Good afternoon, everyone. We have kind of an ambitious agenda, so we're going to jump right into it. And the first bill up today is House File 3347, which I will move before the committee for possible consideration in our bonding proposals, actually. And Representative Simpson, would you like to address your bill?
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I have with me today Mr. Davis from the Community Action Council in New York Mills, and he's going to present this bill. But first of all, I'd like to just give you a little overview that this is a collaborative issue that's been worked out with the school and Community Action, and they've come together with a proposal to do a $260,000 addition to the Verndale School District. So with that being said, Verndale is located on Highway 10, about 175 miles northwest of here, and I will turn it over to Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Dean. Madam Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Davis.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before you this morning and speak in favor of this bill. I think you have a handout that's been passed out to each of you that gives you a little bit of a summary of what we're looking at. We're requesting $260,000 be put into the bonding funds and be used as a grant to the Verndale School District to construct a family resource early childhood center on the Verndale campus. I think one of the unique things about our project is we've been a collaborative since 2002 trying to put this project proposal together. And this new resource center would provide space and services for early childhood family education, school readiness, Head Start, early childhood special education, preschool child care, before and after school age care, family lending library, office and family conference spaces, which currently are not available in the Verndale School at this time. One of the other unique aspects of our request is that we would like to use our youth build group at the senior high school to actually construct the center. They do a house every year, and we're trying to encourage them to consider putting this facility together for us. If they're not able to do it, or if we could do it in conjunction with the Department of Correction crews, which our agency currently uses to build housing, we could put the center together at a relatively low cost. If you take a look at the second page in your handout, you'll see that we've been, blessed with a good enrollment, which isn't usual for a lot of our rural schools. But Verndale School has a full enrollment, and we've had to give up space for our early childhood programming. We lost 300 square feet of space. But I think the most important issue there is we lost a classroom that had two bathrooms. Any of you with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds, you know, when they got to go, they got to go. And with one toilet in the classroom, it gets to be a pretty good juggling act. So due to space issues, we were not able to stay in the classroom where we had sufficient toilets for our children. We also don't have sufficient space for rest time. We run a child care center there as well. So kids have to move out of the classroom, go into the early childhood offices in order to have their rest period throughout the day. Because we're down to one 860 square foot classroom, we're limited in expansion. And as I said, Verndale is blessed with an increase in some of their early childhood programming enrollment. I think the third item that we wanted to bring before you is that we do a lot of family education sessions through this program. And these have to be scheduled at times when the preschool classroom is not occupied, and that's hard to find. That leaves us with evening sessions and one session on Fridays, where the number of kids are small enough to allow us to do that. The current preschool classroom does not provide any space for parenting classes, a family resource library, or age-appropriate setting for infant-toddler classes. These services would be provided in the new facility once it has been built. We currently have to cart everything around the school from different sites in order to bring them to wherever the classes are being held. We also have a high need for child care, and we currently do provide child care through the limited space that we have. I think if you take a look at the next page, you'll see what the collaboration has been over the years. Since September of 2002, our agency has been working with the Verndale School District to see if there's a way that we could consolidate all of the early childhood programs. In November of 2002, they asked our agency and our Head Start program if we would take over that responsibility, which we have done. We got a grant from the Central Minnesota Initiative Fund to begin to put together an Early Childhood Advisory Council, which has been in operation since July of 2003. And that grant helped them sit down and put together what you see before you now is the proposal for an Early Childhood Family Services Resource Center for the school. I think in closing, I'd like to say that in June of 2004, we helped the school district secure a 21st century grant for a 3-year funded period. And that program works with preschool and after-school activities and tutoring resources and provides tutoring resources to the students in the school. So on our council, we have Head Start, Early Childhood Family Education, School Readiness, Early Childhood Special Education, Title I, Community Education, and the 21st Century Community Learning Center, teachers from the school and school board members. We think this is a tremendous opportunity for the community, for the parents, and for the children in the Verndale School District, and hope that you would seek to support our request for a bonding grant of $260,000. The next page gives you the breakdown of what the costs would be to put that facility together, and I believe the chair has a copy that would show the diagrams of the building. We didn't put that in everyone's copy. But it's a relatively good-sized facility. It'd be 3,000 square feet, and we're estimating that it would cost around $260,000 to build if we had to go and contract for the services to build it. That price probably would be reduced if we're able to use our youth build students to build a portion of it, or our Department of Correction crews. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have on our proposal.
So, Mr. Davis, if I understand you correctly, you are only adding a small room onto what you already have.
We have a classroom in the elementary school at this time, and what we would be doing is adding a 3,000-square-foot resource center onto the school building, yes. It would be on the campus for the Verndale School.
And is this the combined, you have a partnership with Ottertail and Modena?
Yes.
Is that a combined school district or just for this? This just for this project?
Just for this project. Ottertail Medina Community Action Council is a community action agency, and we run the Head Start program for both Ottertail and Wadena counties. We've had a Head Start program in the Verndale School for many, many years. And it's just in September that they asked if we would consider taking over all of the early childhood activities, which we have done. So we have a true collaboration of our two agencies and the district.
Did you have any further comments or other questions from members of the committee? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious about the project itself. Is there any local resources being put into this?
Well, as we develop the project, if we put it together, and again, it depends on the funding, if we're able to use our youth build kids to do the actual construction, that will cut costs down significantly. The school would be donating the land and the space. Our agency would look and see what we could do in assisting with the construction. We have two Department of Labor crews that build houses, so I don't have an exact cost figure for that, but yes, we would be putting some dollars into the project as well.
One further question, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Has there been an attempt at all to do a bond referendum or something like that locally to fund this on your own?
No.
Okay, thank you.
And how long have you been planning this, Mr. Davis?
This started in 2003 with a grant from the Central Initiative Fund to create the Early Childhood Council, or the Preschool Advisory Council, and they have been meeting for 2 years to put this together. The grant allowed us to do the design and put together the package that you have here. The school is unusual. Most of other schools are losing enrollment. This school happens to be gaining, and they moved to all-day, all-year kindergarten. That took up the previous classroom space that we have, and they're not projecting any new space in the next year. So
Are you gaining enrollment or losing enrollment, sir?
I believe in the elementary school they were gaining, which is very unusual. I can't speak for the secondary school. They may be losing a little bit. But.
Okay. Are there any further questions from members? All right, if not, thank you very much for making the trip down here, and thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish, I believe your bill is House File 3421, right?
Well, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, would you like me to move that?
Yes, would you please?
Madam Chair, I will move Representative Cornish's 3421 to be before the committee and for consideration to be included in our omnibus bonding bill.
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Cornish.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to make sure, a technical question here is, I want to make sure we got the right bill. I had two of them. I want to withdraw the bill from consideration on straight bonding and want to just take up the facilities grant, if we could just check that number to make sure that's the correct one.
Yes, Madam Chair, I did move 3421. And I did say bonding, but if this is a different program, then I stand corrected.
I think this one would authorize bonds. It's very similar to what Representative Peterson presented the other day that we ran out of time for. So I think it's appropriate that we discuss it, because how similar is it to Representative Peterson's bill?
Madam Chair and members, I think it's probably a clone. It's very similar with different insertions for the school district and amount. And Madam Chair, could I offer author's amendment at this time?
Oh, yes, you may.
What I would like to do is change the totals that you see. I believe they say the totals are 10 million.
Are you on page 2? Mm-hmm.
Yes, the total is... wherever you see the total 10 million, I believe it's in
229.
Right.
22.
Two different spots.
Okay, that's on pages 2, 6, and 7. And what are you changing, sir?
I would like to change that to 12,335,000.
How'd you come up with such an even number?
Well, the total cost of the project, Madam Chair and members, is 24,670,000, so we split it in half.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, this bill is what is called a facilities grant.
Madam Chair, I'll move that amendment. Excuse me, Representative Cornish.
Is everybody clear what the amendment is? In three locations in the bill, we are changing 10 million to 12,335,000, correct?
Correct.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right.
Madam Chair and members, this is a facilities grant bill, and what it allows is funding from the state into a facilities grant that would be granted to the school upon an application process, and it would be both for reconstruction or remodeling or building new facilities. It qualifies for all three from the wording of the bill. The people coming before you today, first I'd like to just introduce them over those folks from Wells and USC, wave your hand. And then behind me here, with some students here. Coming before you today, that a lot of schools will come and they'll want funding for schools because it was nice to have a bigger school, make it more efficient education, aesthetic value, lots of different reasons, and for good reasons, but we're coming to you today with a school that is literally falling apart. Seriously. It's up against the wall for code violations, and I would like to, if the page could hand these around, if we could keep these moving from member to member, they're pictures of the actual facility in the state it's at. The bond referendum, we've had a hard time passing in USC, and what I would like to do is introduce Christy Wetzel, who is on the school board. and she would like to give you a 5-minute presentation on the USC and its condition and state.
All right. This is at Wetzel.
Wetzel. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here.
They're old and they're falling apart around and sometimes on top of us. Isn't that a horrible way to describe the buildings designed to educate our children? Welcome to school life at United South Central. These are the same buildings our children will spend hundreds of hours for 13 years of their life learning everything essential to become productive, contributing members of society. We teach them reading, writing, mathematics, and so much more in buildings the Minnesota Department of Education has deemed less than safe, according to the 2003 advisory letter. And I quote, USC's facilities will continue to age and deteriorate, as will the environment for learning and teaching that supports students' achievement efforts and their preparations for the challenges of the 21st century. I am here today as a mother of elementary students, a concerned citizen, a school board member, and most importantly, as a representative for the voices that aren't heard, our USC students. I am supported today by members of USC's communities, other concerned citizens, officials of our local governments, business people, parents, and students. Thanks to you for giving me the opportunity to share our needs and to show you the situation we are faced with. Some of you have toured our buildings and have seen firsthand the building issues that plague our district. For those of you who haven't, allow me to take a few minutes to give you a factual tour of the world our students struggle with, Monday through Friday, September to May, preschool to graduation. The USC district is home to 888 students from 6 communities. We have a high school and elementary in Wells and a middle school in Keister. Our current building issues include age. We are in the oldest 2.7% of all school districts in Minnesota. We're ranked 333 out of 342 schools in reference to age. Our middle school was built in 1929. Our high school and elementary were built in 1932 and 33. Our educational deficiencies are numerous, and they include undersized classrooms, many at 600 and 700 square feet, compared with Minnesota State guidelines of 900 square feet. Our special needs programs do not have adequate or appropriate space. 20 traditional classrooms are needed for a variety of special education services, student support programs, preschool classes, and computer technology. Small classrooms do not have space for computers, and our buildings cannot accommodate the networks and the electrical needs of the technology. Many areas are not handicapped accessible. Our indoor air quality requirements are not met because of aging ventilation systems, and we have very limited building security measures. Our structural deficiencies are even more numerous. Our lack of a building-wide sprinkling system, we have no safe drop-off and pick-up locations for children, and our school is in fact located on a major highway. Our building is deteriorating due to age and construction style. Our existing steam boilers and piping, temperature control systems, and galvanized piping need to be replaced. It is not uncommon for neighboring classrooms to have 15-degree temperature differences. Our electrical service panels are outdated and inadequate. Electrical outlets in classrooms are inadequate, and in many cases, there's only one or two outlets in the classroom. All of our roofs are more than 20 years old and need to be replaced. Plastic swimming pools and buckets catching water are common sights. Most windows are single pane and are not energy efficient. Our acoustic tiles need to be replaced, and often they're falling on top of students' heads and books. Our existing gyms are outdated, undersized, and represent a safety hazard. We've had 3 referendum failed votes. In April of 2002, we went to the voters with a $32 million new building. 25% voted yes, 75% voted no. In May of 2005, we voted again on a new building, this time for $24,675,000. 40% said yes, 60% said no. 6 months later, we came back in December of 2005, the same referendum amount, 42% said yes, 58% said no. Paying for our school is the major issue. 70% of a bond is paid for a new school will be paid for by agricultural land taxes. And outside investors have caused our land values and property taxes to increase at an unrealistic rate for the local farmers who purchase land for thousands less an acre. Our non-homestead farmland valued at $3,000 an acre would have been taxed an additional $9.21 an acre for 25 years. We do not qualify for debt equalization, and we are, in fact, an impoverished school district. 48% of our students school-wide receive free and reduced-price lunches. I've shared some demographic comparisons of USC, Red Lake, Net Lake, and Ivanhoe Lake Benton, and the pictures show essentially the same ability to pay. Yet USC isn't proposing a $55-plus million remodel and renovation project, and we don't qualify for any type of state aid. We are here today looking for equality. Our students have to make do in buildings where the drinking fountains are covered in plastic to prevent their use, or forced to shower after Fayed using water that is foul. Is this fair? Is this equal? I implore you to examine the situation and help us financially. We are willing to pay our share. Everyone in our communities agree we need to do something with our buildings. The truth is, we will never pass a bond referendum because of the cost to the taxpayers. Until we have some sense of equality with regard to the percentage paid by our ag landowners, USC will remain at a critical crossroads. I ask you, will USC have a building to meet the needs of children receiving a 21st century education, or will we be forced to continue on until all of our buildings are condemned and the health and well-being of our community's children is jeopardized? Thank you.
Are there questions for members of the committee? Thank you very much, Mrs. Wetzel. The pipes that you passed around?
Yes.
Did those fall out of the ceiling?
No, actually, there were leaky pipes that had to be cut out and patched and replaced. Our pipes are a constant problem. And if you look at the end, you'll see that some of those are completely packed with rust.
Representative Cleansing.
Thank you. You mentioned the pipes being a problem, and you also said something about renovation in your testimony. Could you summarize again whether it's possible to just replace the pipes and what kinds of aid you do or do not qualify with regards to renovating as opposed to rebuilding?
Absolutely. We had a task force that was assembled in 2004 to look at all of the different options. Just to bring our buildings up to essentially zero, where there's no problems, it doesn't address any of the educational deficiencies, would be about $11 million. And that's kind of a guesstimate. We've looked at remodel costs, and they actually happen to be about 10% less than the cost of a new building. Truly, our facilities committee spent 2 years looking at all of the different options, and the most economically sound for the future of our school district was a new pre-K through 12 facility.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to verify that information. I did go to three of the facilities meetings that they had around various locations around the school district and listen to the presentations, and I believe the cost would be prohibitive to actually remodel. I don't think the MDE lets you do that if it's so much a percentage towards the cost of a new building. And they did have independent people come in and look at the place. It was just too much of a bill to remodel and fix. So it looks like construction is the only option.
So you become ineligible for any kind of aid because of the increasing value of the farmland?
Correct.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Did you do a demographics similar to what you did for Faribault, Red Lake, St. Louis, and Lincoln County based on those projects? Did you do one for your community?
I did one for, you should have it in there for USC. It should fall under Faribault County. Part of our school district actually falls in Fremont County, but it's a relatively small area in Fremont County. And their demographics are essentially the same as ours. I believe that their house value was a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Overlooked. Any further questions? Hearing none. Thank you very much, Representative Hornish, Mrs. Wetzel, for your...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know the people here were actually shaking with glee to get here and finally get, you know, their message out, so yes. Really appreciative.
We appreciate your time. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Was there any further discussion on Representative Cornish's proposal, which isn't really for bond dollars, but to put some money into... Facilities Fund, the Consolidation Cooperation Fund. Does anybody wish to comment on that? Representative
I do have a question about this is an expansion to K-12, and I wanted to know what the history was of why it was limited to secondary schools only.
Madam Chair, Representative Clinton,
Mr. Strong.
The Cooperative Secondary Facilities Program was passed in 1987, and former Representative Glenn Anderson was the primary force behind passing the bill. At that time, the thinking was that, and school districts, a lot of the rural school districts were a fair amount larger than they are now, the thinking was that school would need about three sections in order to offer essentially a competitive secondary level. And so his goal was to create high schools, to leave the elementaries alone, but to create high schools that would be large enough to be a three-section high school. That, as I said, was passed in 1987 and began before the round of school consolidations that really started in earnest in about 1990. And what's happened since that time is a great number of school districts, more than 150 school districts, have consolidated. And in those consolidated districts now, their enrollments, even in the consolidated districts, are quite a bit smaller than they were 15 years ago. And many of the consolidated districts are now realizing that running a single K-12 facility may be more efficient than keeping separate elementary schools open. So when the bill was initially passed, the argument behind it was only the secondary levels that need to be consolidated for purposes of the course offerings. But I think many of the consolidated districts now are realizing that keeping two or three elementary schools open is a fairly cost prohibitive approach.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair, just a comment then. It seems like this could have also the effect of leading to some consolidation of elementary schools, much like it has historically done with the secondary schools. Just wanted to, I guess, put that out there for, I don't know how I feel one way or the other, but just for consideration as we move forward on this one.
And is there anybody else here who would like to testify or comment on this proposal, because this is a relatively new proposal, and I think it's easy to understand why it has been brought to us, but I'm not sure we really fully understand what the cost or the consequences of doing this would be. So if there's anybody who wishes to address the committee briefly, they may have that ability.
Yes, thank you, and members. I'm sorry I just come in, so I missed the testimony this morning. Renee Hasbargen, Minnesota Rural Education Association. But let me just make one comment. Back when a number of districts, see and seed, they were given incentive money by the state to cooperate and then to combine. They spent their time coming together in a consolidation, and in order to get that politically done in their communities, they found that they had to keep a school presence in every community. And so what we spent a lot of time doing in the mid-80s to the mid-90s was using state dollars to rehab the K-12 that had existed in all these little communities, and then rehabbing them into an elementary school in one community and a middle school in the next and a high school in the other one. And as a result, we kept a lot of old facilities, and we didn't close buildings at the time the way we probably should have done. In fact, I remember how a superintendent would counsel other superintendents going through the process, you're better off to shut this or to close the school right off the bat when you're trying to work to get this political agreement. So we understand fully the need of a district like United South Central. And this has this is not the only community this kind of thing is playing out in. I can point to a number of those consolidated districts under CNC who now need to replace their facilities, and they're having problems doing it for a variety of reasons. But partly it was to get the political buy-in in the first place. We still kept school presence in all these small communities. And so this is taking it to another step.
Any questions for the witness? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hasbargen, so you worked on these various bills of this type, and this is MREA's best proposal for taking care of that problem.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Greiling, no, this isn't probably the best proposal, but this is certainly something that needs to be a part of the options that we have as a state to look at. We would strongly support this particular approach. And we found in the past using bonding dollars creatively can make some things happen that the state wants to have happen and create some efficiencies. I believe that list that Mr. Strom has put in your packet for $32 million over the course of 10 years. You got 19 communities to consolidate their schools. And that was a pretty good investment when you start looking at the efficiencies that might have been built. We could have built even more efficiencies, I think, if we would have gone with K-12s at the time, as this bill does now.
In your opinion, is there an advantage to keeping the small schools, small elementary schools in each community, for instance, versus having everybody bused to one large school?
Madam Chair, certainly we would hope that schools could stay as close to the student as possible in the elementary. But we also know that in many of our communities, the age of our buildings is getting to be very, very problematic. And so every community is going to have to approach this on their own and determine what's best for them based on the age and the sort of health of their building.
I'd ask you one more question, and then Representative Demmer has a question. This issue that we're talking about, is it driven more by the fact that land valuations are moving up rapidly? And I think you're being hit with what some of us in the suburban areas have been hit with for the last 10 years, and that's the rapidly increasing valuations of properties. And that's what's making it harder for you to pass referendums.
Madam Chair and members, yes, when you look at the rising property value and the declining number of pupils, because the formula, the debt service equalization formula, for example, is driven off of your property wealth per pupil. So as your students drop and your values go up, you as a district look more and more wealthy all the time. And that's why so many districts have fallen off the debt service equalization formula. But you're going to be dealing with that in a minute, and I don't need to go there. But this isn't just a matter of ag land carrying the burden either. I think it's the fact that the whole debt service formula right now isn't working for any district out there.
All right. Was there anybody else who wished to briefly testify?
My name is Heidi Goldman. I was on the USC Facilities Committee. As Christy told you, we had been meeting since 2004. We looked at every option available, from just fixing to what we ultimately recommended was a new building. Somebody asked a question about keeping kids closer to the schools. That was in reference to elementary. But what's happening in our district is our population center is mainly in the Wells area. We're busing 70% of our kids to middle school right now. The fuel costs alone for that are astronomical with the price of fuel the way it is right now. We could save, by going to a one-site school, $348,000 a year. That's money that can be used for education, that can be used for programs that right now we are just spending keeping two buildings open. We think that's a lot of money that we could be using a lot better, that we could be spending for the kids instead of just keeping, you know, maintenance, trying to fix roofs. It's not like we've let these buildings purposely fall down, but when you have a limited budget, there's only so much fixing you can do, and when you've got $10 million worth of just code issues to meet, you can't get there by just fixing. We think if we had that $348,000 a year, it would really go a long ways towards serving the students in our district.
Thank you, Ms. Goldman. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any questions. I have a comment, and I think it deals with our whole rural community meeting today, Madam Chair. United South Central, I've been to the school. I'm from Hayfield. I was there recently. We played in basketball, and I've seen the facility. With all due respect, it's it's something that each one of us had a chance to visit, you would say, oh, I remember being in a school like this 30 years ago. It is that type of school. It needs, there's no question that anybody looking at it, and I think the residents of that district would agree something needs to be done. I think what it really gets to is the point of the matter that we have here is we have three different things we're dealing with, and the CNC type of monies is to encourage consolidation maybe where it needs a little help when you have multiple communities having to do a buy-in. USC folks, as an example, consolidated their school district because of the right thing for their kids and not necessarily because they were incented with money, so that might not be the case in their deal. But I think it does get to the other two points, and that is overall burden for a school district and then who has the burden in that district when you talk about capital levies. I think with the testimony that we heard earlier talked about the ag land owners having probably a disproportionate share of the burden, and that's why, even though they probably would all agree something needs to be done, the burden is not proportional. It's out of whack, and I think that's what we're talking about, equalization. And then, of course, the other issue we have is equity, which we talked about also, and that gets to the issue of overall burden of a district. So you have the total dollars that a district has locally to deal with, and then you have how that burden is distributed. And I think in dealing with equalization, we need to keep in mind the manifestation of the what we'll be talking about is USC. I think there's many districts throughout the state that are going to be like that, and I think we need to keep that in mind as we go forward, talking about the burden total, state versus local, and then in the local area, whatever is local, how that's distributed as we go forward, Madam Chair. So that would be my comments as we keep perspective on this whole issue.
Thank you. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Demmer hit a number of the points because I, too, have had the chance to tour the building about a little over a year ago. And I hope everybody does take a look at the pictures that they sent around. I could almost say they picked the better side of the school to show in the pictures. That it really, and I know the community, the agreement is not, it's there for the need to do something. It's how to get there. My question is, maybe Mr. Strom can help me, just because this is expanding a program, was there some rationale for going from the $6 million cap to the $11 million cap? Is that based on what the value of $6 million today? Is it more based on just what people were saying they needed? Just why that detail and the expansion? And I'm looking at the bill brief, not the the amendment that
Madam
we
Chair,
moved to represent.
Representative Dorn, in terms of the total value of the project, when the bill was first passed in 1987, the limit was up to $8 million, or 75% of the project cost. So they were really expecting that a new secondary facility could be built for somewhere in the $12 or $15 million range. And so essentially, the initial draft updated that amount to reflect more likely the cost of construction. I think a district would be very hard pressed to build a secondary facility for with the local share being only $10 million of at 75%, I think that's still probably understating the construction costs for most districts.
Thank you,
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering about state law. Does state law allow traditional public schools to lease facilities for the schools rather than constructing and owning? Is it possible for a public school to lease a facility?
They can lease up to a certain percent of an existing building, so they could lease, like, I think 20% more space and pay for that by levying.
And, Madam Chair, is that levy a discretionary levy, or is that a levy subject to referendum?
That's not subject to referendum. If the district needs to, am I correct in that?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I think we will move on to the next bill. And I want you all to think about the fact that, the only time there's been state money going out for construction of schools was under the old consolidation rule. Now what this would do is try to get money in the bonding bill to establish a fund for states, for schools, individual schools. And you know, what you have to be thinking about, what is the statewide interest of doing something like this? Because this is something new to bonding that we have not done before. So this would be a somewhat new precedent. So just something to think about. We'll have our bonding discussion maybe tomorrow on the proposals for bonding. All right? All right, let's move on to Representative Soderstrom. And Representative Erickson, I believe you were going to be up there at the same time and then do your bill, and then we would go to Representative Lanning. And while they are getting prepared, I will ask Mr. Strom, do you all have this little piece of paper? Okay. I would ask him to explain this. What we're looking at in the next three bills is debt service equalization and different proposals and what they actually do. Okay?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3304 for possible inclusion in the K-12 omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Erickson. And Mr. Strom, would you explain this piece of paper before we start?
Madam Chair, members, let me spend just a couple seconds running through this single sheet piece of paper that's labeled debt service options for you, and then address three issues related to how we're costing out each of these debt service proposals. The next three bills you're going to hear have to do with changing the debt service equalization aid program. What the table does, it's divided into two halves. On the left half, it presumes that we keep the current tax base. When we get to Representative Erickson's bill, the right half of the worksheet has to do with replacing that tax base with a different sales ratio, an ANTC, where the sales ratio adjusts for the estimated market value of the property. What these tables do, they're both the same thing, other than the tax base change, is measure how much in additional revenue it would cost, additional state aid as on an aid entitlement basis it would cost to modify any part of the debt equalization formula. So as you go down the left side, the left column there, you can see if you were to raise the first tier from $3,200 to $4,000, the cost would be $1.4 million. If you were to raise it to $6,000, the cost would be $11.9 million. Then as you move to the right, not only is the first tier equalizing factor changing, but also the tiers, the amount of tax base that's in each of the tiers is changing. And you can see as those tiers get smaller and therefore more aid falls into them, that the costs go up. So essentially what you'll be looking at with the three bills today are different variations on setting the equalizing factor and setting the amount of revenue that's in each of these tiers. For purposes of the bills that you're looking at, this will be, I'm afraid, a little bit of a surprise to your testifiers today, but we do finally have the Pay07 data up and running, and that's going to be the data based on February forecast data that we're going to need to use to cost out these bills. So they're slightly different than the numbers that the legislators have been working with up until this point in time. The cost that's shown on each of the printouts is the aid entitlement cost of simply changing the equalizing factors and the tiers. A second part of several of the bills includes changes to the index, essentially to index the equalizing factors. These costs are not included, and depends on what year we'll start the indexing for these costs to be brought forward. We'll make some estimates as we go through today to talk about that a bit. But the indexing is not built into the printouts you're looking at. And then third, whenever we change the aid levy mix of a program, the Department of Finance assumes that there will be some behavioral effects. And that means essentially that if we put more debt service equalization aid into a program, we're likely to have more success of local bond issues passing. So as a result of that, we will also have an aid and levy cost associated with behavioral changes. Those will be relatively small amounts, but that is a third cost that you'll see. And again, that doesn't show up on the printout because we don't assign that to a school district. So in summary, Madam Chair, the table shows you what some of those different options will look like. The runs are showing you the changes of the equalizing factors, and we'll have some other costs associated with that as we put our bill together.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And members, anytime you have a question, please feel free to ask that question. Mr. Strom is an expert on this stuff, and probably some of the people who testify are experts on this also. Oh, I'm sorry. And we have also Mr. Hines with us, so that if we have questions on tax base, et cetera. Thank you for being here. All right. Representative Soderstrom, would you like to proceed with your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, my name is Judy Soderstrom, and I am the State Representative for District 8B. And House File 3304 is a bill relating to operating referendum equalization aid. While Minnesota has been a leader in providing equitable funding for education, it's time to revisit one of the primary mechanisms for ensuring equity. When operating referendum equalization aid was first introduced in Minnesota in 1991, $476,000 was determined as the original equalizing factor. It has not been changed since 1991. And despite the dramatic growth in property values, debt service equalization aid is based on net tax capacity, NTS. Most school districts' net tax capacity grew an average of 88% between 1995 and 2004. My proposal would make the following changes. The first tier factor for operating referendum equalization aid would increase from that $476,000 to $650,000. The cost for this change would be approximately $72 million. And there would be approximately 285 schools would get more aid. And you'll have to correct me here if I'm making mistakes. That's what I understood. The second part of my bill relates to debt service equalization aid, and this aid would change as follows. The first equalizing factor would increase from $3,200 to $5,000, and the second equalizing factor would remain at $8,000, and then the tiers would change from 15% and 25% to 10% and 20%. Well, what this change means is that under the current system, a school district pays the first 15% locally, and then between 15 and 25%, or the next 10%, it's equalized at $3,200. And beyond 25%, it's equalized at $8,000. Under my proposal, a school district would be paying the first 10% locally instead of the 15%, and then between 10 and 20% would be equalized at $5,000. And then beyond 20%, it would be equalized at $8,000. And I believe 76 more schools would qualify for help under this provision. And this bill would increase debt service equalization aid and correspondingly reduce debt service levies by about $17 million a year. So thank you.
All right, did you wish to add anything else, or you have with you?
Madam Chair, I have my bill, too, which I will move in a moment, but maybe we have some questions for Representative Soderstrom.
Is the witness testifying on Representative Soderstrom on your bill? All right. So I think what we'll do is we'll have you discuss yours, and then I think we will, and Representative Lanning, and then we'll try to get some understanding of the different costs and the different things each of the bills does and the costs involved. Representative, was there a question?
Yes. Well, Representative Sikora, Madam Chair, I think the superintendent here is willing to comment on this. Do you want him to do that?
If you wish to comment, you may, sir.
Brett Nolan, Superintendent Schools Foley. When I get partway into 3043, I can point out the differences between Representative Soderstrom's bill and our and 3043. I think that would be the best way to do that. All of them are related, and so they're you can compare them that way.
All right, thank you, Representative Erickson. Let's
thank you, Chair Sikora. I'd like to move House File 3043 to be before the committee and considered for possible inclusion in whatever kind of bill we come up with.
The Omnibus Education Bill.
Yeah, I think we're sure yet. Thank you. And Superintendent Nolan is here to actually make the presentation, but I want to
tell members that something different about 3043 is that we have an index for the equalizing factors so that the equalization will grow with the per pupil tax base. And that could bring about a consistency and a constancy over time. Otherwise, our bills are quite similar, except that my percentages are different. And finally, I do have an adjustment to the sales ratio, which is that artificial number that the Department of Revenue uses to calculate school taxes. But Superintendent Nolan is going to present some of that detail. So with that, Madam Chair, I think we'd like to watch the PowerPoint that my superintendent Foley has taken so much time to prepare.
All right. Let's go ahead with that, Mr. Nolan. Thank you.
House file, members of the committee, House file 3043, both reforms and restores debt service. And it's great that we have some school districts here from Wells and some other school districts. So we can actually pick out as examples and see what's not working for them in terms of debt service equalization. First couple slides, if you have it there, can walk through very quickly that prior to 1992-93, there was no debt service equalization. That started both debt service and referendum equalization. So poor school districts could have quality facilities for students. So poor school districts could afford equal opportunity throughout the state. That's what equalization is all about. There was the Skeen case. Those who were here, Tim Strom and some representatives, would know the history there. This is where it all began. And the debt service equalization began with fiscal year 92-93. There was a three-year phase-in. Several changes have happened since then, most notably in 2001 with the class compression rates and the change to a two-tier system from a one-tier system. There were also changes made in the maximum for capital loan at that point, but that was the last major approach to debt service equalization. The current law says you must have a threshold. Your first 15% of your building project has to be totally paid by local funds. I think it's useful to look at South Central, what United South Central's numbers here. They have a current debt tax of 0.6%. Mm-hmm. So basically 15% of ANTC in that district is totally funded locally. They don't have that tax right now. I can understand the sticker shock in United South Central. And then secondly, the equalization factor is $3,200 per pupil in the first year and $8,000 in the second year. Those numbers have not changed since 2001. The idea is, now I've been warned here not to put you to sleep, but I do ask you to look at the math here. This is a math problem, okay? First, the tier one, the required debt service, the first 15% is totally local. So when people talk 10%, 12%, 15% in Tim Strom's chart, which, by the way, he's got a marvelous spreadsheet, and Steve Hines has helped out on the tax side of this very much, that's what they're talking about. How much of that initial percentage is going to be locally supported? Obviously, 10% is less than 15%. But that's what comes off the top first, and that's what the locals have to pay. That's the way the formula works. Then the amount of debt that the district has to pay in a year is now subject to debt service equalization aid. However, it's debt service, the eligible amount, times the ANTC over adjusted pupils divided by the equalization factor. Now, you've heard a couple times about equalization factors. You've heard 5,000, 5,500, different numbers. That's the equalization factor. Right now, it's at 3,200. You've also heard the comment that there's fewer pupils in the state from Bernie Hasbargen. The reason is that if you have a district that goes from, say, 700 pupils down to 500 pupils, all of a sudden your wealth increases. Your homeowners' wealth didn't increase, but your wealth, as far as this formula, increases because you have fewer students. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex formula, but these are the important pieces. What's the threshold, that percentage number? How does pupil count interact, and how does the equalization factor interact here? So eventually you get the debt service eligible for aid, which you factored out, minus your local portion, finally equals your debt service equalization aid. Remember, your total levy, your local levy, is going to be a percentage of ANTC plus the local levy portion of the debt service that's eligible for aid, which is ranges in a percentage based on district by district. Okay. Now, in 1994, there was $193 million of debt out there in the state. Now there's $688 million. And a lot of consolidation, a lot of districts, even suburban districts that have built schools. In 1995, $27.5 million of that, $11.3 was funded with state dollars. Now it's up to $37.4 million in 2004, but look at the percentage. It's down to 4.6%. In fact, I've got a chart that shows now it's less than 4% state funds. So 96% of the school facility effort in the state of Minnesota is being funded with local taxpayer dollars. And the question is that the fair percentage? Because we all have to educate kids throughout the state. I think you want, if you've got a grandchild or a niece in Wells, you'd like them to have as nearly as good education as in any other part of the state. And with the debt service formula working this way, with 96% being local, statewide, you see some of the issues and why this is such an important topic. Now, here's a chart that I'd like you to look at. You have it in black and white. The bottom line is the average ANTC per pupil. In 1995, that was $3,630 per pupil. If you are following along on the PowerPoint, we're back on page 6. The chart in the bottom, page 6. When debt service equalization was introduced, the equalization factor was set to be 1.25 times the average ANTC in the state. Okay? So more districts qualified than not. All right? And for a couple of years, by legislative action, that factor was changed and moved upward as the ANTC per pupil, the average ANTC per pupil, increased. You'll notice that stopped about 1999. Those of you who are here know that was kind of the state kind of ran into some financial troubles, and this was one of the ways to save money, was not to keep increasing that equalization factor. Finally, in 2001, the lines crossed. Okay? So now you had fewer than half the districts in the state qualifying for equalization aid. Then there was a class compression rate between 2002 and 2003. You see both lines declined approximately the same. Okay? So that worked out relatively well. For most school districts. But notice since 2003, the equalization factors remain constant at $3,200, while ANTC per pupil, as we all know, property inflation in the state has just screamed north. And so you have fewer and fewer districts qualifying for aid, and those that are qualifying are receiving less and less aid. In fact, there's been a 43% increase in ANTC per pupil over the last 3 years. So, in 1995, only 14.4% of the districts did not qualify for equalization aid. Now, 75.6% do not. And if we look at United South Central, their ANTC per pupil, since they're here today, is $6,700 per pupil. They're over twice the equalization factor. They don't qualify under the current formula. And we'll talk at the end about what some options are. I think Representative Demmer really gave a nice perspective on what some of the options for the state are to address issues like Wells and other districts in the state. So what went wrong? Property values increased. ANTC per pupil has increased 42%, in part because there's fewer pupils, but in large part because the property has increased. They haven't kept pace, and also limited market value is distorting ANTC, and that's why Steve Hines is here, is to help us understand that. So it's really overestimating statewide ANTC by about 6%. And construction costs have increased. Anybody who knows who tries to build a home, that construction costs have definitely increased. Now, I've got three pages here. I'm not going to go through this, but if you look at pages 8 and 9, these are three good examples. I owe Ehlers and Associates for this chart. This is Janesburg, Walberton, Pemberton, and they held the debt equal in all three of these. Line 12 is equal in all 3 years. And it said, okay, let's take their adjusted net tax capacity, line 1, and their pupil units, line 2, and let's run the formula in 94-95, when debt service first came in, in 2002-2003, right after the reforms of 2001, and today. And in all three cases, you will see a precipitous drop in equalization aid. In this case, Janesburg, Walden, Pemberton, their adjusted net tax capacity increased quite a bit, but their pupils dropped off dramatically. And they've gone from getting about $300,000 in aid on $1 million to zero. Next one is Albert Lee. Adjusted net capacity increased about 40%. Pupils remained relatively constant. They were getting approximately $1 million in aid on $3 million in debt. Now they're getting zero. Centennial. Their valuations have gone, well, they've over doubled. Their pupils have increased, but not doubled. They went from getting $3.7 million in aid on about $8.5 million in debt, maybe 40%, down to getting $242,000 in aid on $8 million in debt, about 95% local. 3043 takes a comprehensive approach to this. It restores debt service equalization by increasing the state debt service aid and lowering 141 districts' local debt service levies. It increases the first tier to 5,500, reduces the thresholds to 12 and 22%, which is 12%, which is what it was when debt service equalization was first brought in. 5,500 was chosen because, if you remember, ANTC per pupil is about 5,000. This tries to get the equalization factor above the ANTC per pupil. It also reforms debt service equalization through the elimination of the effects of limited market value and to adjust equalization factors annually with a statewide property inflation. First, it reforms it to the inflation rate. I've just got the same stats here. 75 schools have been, quote, pushed off the formula. At one point they received aid, now they no longer receive aid. Superintendents will tell you, and I'll tell you my story. When I was in Eden Valley Watkins, I told the public that the state was going to pay about 40% of a building cost. They asked me, well, could that change? And I went through the factors and said, yeah, it could change. The legislature could change it as well. I had no idea that 4 years later, 100% of the cost would be paid by the local taxpayers. I mean, they've got a right to complain. And what they do is they look at us and say, you lied to us. Well, no. Property values in a lake and agriculture school district went due north over the last 4 years. And the suburban districts may have experienced this earlier, but this is certainly the effect in rural Minnesota. Now, historically, this may be abnormally high, but we have gone through this time period, and so it may continue, and it may come back at some time in the future. So 3043 directs the Revenue Department to calculate an ANTC per pupil adjustment annually to keep the debt service equalization aid proportionate. And Tim Strom and Steve can explain the details of this, exactly how it works. And I think there's a technical amendment coming on this as well. I think it will create more faith in the system. Because what you don't want to do is tell people that the state's going to pick up a certain portion and very quickly not have that happen. Even though it's built into the formula, when you lock in one portion, such as the equalization factor, this can very easily happen. Now, it reforms debt service equalization by eliminating the effects of limited market value. I akin this to peeling back the onion. You've got this basic formula, everybody says ANTC. ANTC is going to equalize everything. And it does. But when you peel it back and say, how is ANTC calculated, you see a distortion that comes in due to the sales ratio, and it's due to limited market value. Because currently, adjusted net tax capacity is your net tax capacity divided by your sales ratio. And net tax capacity is what people actually get taxed on. And for many people, net tax capacity and estimated market value, which is what the assessor thinks your house is worth, are the same. But for many people in the state, it's not the same. And the reason is because there's purpose behind limited market value. But The sales ratio says the assessor's market value or limited market value, whichever is lower, divided by the sales price done by a sales study, is what your sales ratio is going to be. Now, there's a lot of good purposes for sales ratio studies. The Revenue Department uses them. Leonard Peterson was very helpful in explaining this to me. And we're not talking about doing away with sales ratio studies. Limited market value was created by the legislature as a way to slow down the impact of rising property values on homeowners. And it's also in rural areas, there's a Green Acres program in rural and sort of suburban rural areas, which limits the impact on a farmer of rising property values. And Green Acres is expanding, and limited market value was extended last year to 2008. So it's going to affect ANPC and school formulas through 2010, and it may be extended again. Because the sales ratio is computed by comparing limited market value of the property to its actual sales price, a taxing jurisdiction with a significant amount of property subject to limited market value is going to end up with a higher ANPC. And a higher ANPC reduces the district's levy share of equalization of school finance formulas and increases the total tax bill for maximum per capita loans. There's 20 school districts in the state that their tax bill is tied directly to ANPC. We need to pay 28% of ANPC every year. So if there's a distortion in ANPC, the tax bill for those 20 school districts is increased. And 3043 is not pro or con limited market value. It simply tries to say, let's separate limited market value from the effect on school formulas. These things should be commingled, but let's separate them. The proposal says, let's make sales ratio the assessor's market value divided by the sales price. Not either that or taxable market value, but what the assessor says. So let's take an example here, because you've got a lot of verbiage, and okay, what does this really mean? If you go back to page, let's see what page we're on here in the handout, page 14. Let's assume we have a piece of property that's worth $100,000, that by a sales study. But for some reason, it has a limited market value of $60,000. But the assessor says, no, that should be $90,000. That's 90% of sales ratio. That's right on. Under current law, the sales ratio of this property is 60% because it's 60% of $100,000, $60,000. Under current law, the adjusted net tax capacity is $600 divided by 60% or $1,000. Under House File 3043, sales ratio is 90% because it's the assessor's market value divided by the sales ratio. And so the adjusted net tax capacity is $600 divided by 90% or $667. Now, if you take this district-wide and have a district that has a lot of limited market value, it's going to look a lot wealthier. And when it looks a lot wealthier, it's going to get less aid. When it gets less aid, it's more local burden. And the burden then is distributed over all the taxpayers. Now, so there's no losers within House File 3043 to make this change in the tax base, how you do ANPC. Approximately $10 million of the $34.5 million cost is to make this change. Now, Kim, you just set out new numbers here, and so the cost is not going to be 34. 22.1? Okay, so this slide is wrong. So there's a certain portion of that $22.1 million that's due to making this shift in the base. And you probably look at it by comparing the left column to the left-hand set of charts to the right-hand set of charts. It looks like it's about $6 million to make this change. Now, there's a sheet here. It's portrait. I don't know if you have this one in front of you. It's Steve Hines' analysis. It doesn't say his name at the top. It's analysis of 2004 school district sales ratios. And if you find different districts, the left-hand column is the actual sales ratio today, and the right-hand column is this new estimated market value sales ratio. The statewide average is right at the top. The percentage of underassessment due to limited market value statewide is 31%. Okay? And many districts, a lot more. So the statewide, this raises the sales ratio from 79.5 to 85.8. 31% is due to limited market value. The most affected types of school districts are farm, as well as seasonal rec. There's 100 school districts with 40% or more of their sales ratios through limited market value. There's 35 school districts where 50% or more is due to limited market value. We're talking a fairly significant distortion, over 50%. And the top three, drum roll please. Make your guesses. Where do you think the largest amount of limited market value is? Where have home prices, land prices been growing the fastest? Ready? Malacca and Dover Eota top the list at 65%. Makes sense. One's by Rochester, one's just due north of the cities here. The next one I think is going to be a surprise. St. Paul at 64%. St. Paul and Minneapolis have fairly high limited market values. Now, whether this translates directly into debt service equalization depends on a lot of other factors, specifically how much debt they have, how many pupils they have, all kinds of things. But it's instructive as to where the percentages are. Okay, so those are the two reforms of 3043, adjusting for inflation and changing the base and how ANPC is calculated, removing limited market value. Now, it also restores debt service equalization by increasing the first-year equalization to 5,500, so it's greater than ANPC per pupil, and reducing the thresholds. Now, here's something to think about. You've got different bills. If you increase the equalization factor, 5,500, 6,000, 6,500, you're going to capture more districts for aid, and you're going to give them some aid. United South Central is a good example. It's $6,700 per ANPC. They'll qualify for Tier 2, but they've got to fully tax themselves 22% of ANPC first, and then they just get a little bit of equalization. If you raise first-year equalization, could afford to do it, and raise it to $9,000, $8,000, you could capture those districts. Now, they would get more aid because the you capture more districts the more you raise the equalization factor. Reducing the thresholds gives the districts who are already getting aid on whatever equalization factor you say it is going to be, they get more aid because more of their total debt is eligible for aid. So that's why this chart is so helpful. I mean, it's more a question of how many districts you want to capture. You want to capture the maximum number of districts, you raise the equalization factor, don't lower the threshold. If you want to give the maximum number of aid to the districts already qualified, you don't move the equalization factor very much, you lower the threshold. So people decry doing policy by runs. This is not quite the same thing. It's saying, who should really the state help? I think that's what's represented at Demmer's question. Who should the state help, and how should they do it? So there is a way to capture United South Central and those kind of districts. Keep moving the equalization factor up. And then suburban school districts that qualify, urban school districts that qualify, doesn't matter why you don't have the valuation for pupil, you don't have it. And so the state is going to help you provide that needed facility, that needed restoration, so that you can educate your kids in a very technological 21st century. That means you're putting more into it means, really, how much money do you want to put into this kind of property tax relief? Because that is really what we're talking about here, property tax relief. This is moving the burden from property taxpayers to the general income and sales revenues of the state of Minnesota. But this bill right now would provide property tax relief for 141 school districts, 75 of which right now don't get any aid. I'm making the assumption that all 75 at one time did get aid. I think the comment was made there's behavioral impact of these bills. And yes, one of the ways to get these passed is to be able to say the state is helping local taxpayers pass these. Here's some other general thoughts. You ask the superintendent educator to come down here, I'll give you a couple general thoughts. Equalization factors and threshold numbers depend on the state policy desire and the resources devoted to this. There's nothing magical about those particular numbers. Talked a little bit about that before. I think the role of grants, and Representative Demmer was getting at this, needs to be weighed versus increasing the equalization factors to capture those districts in a statewide formula. Do you want to set up a process where people can apply for grants because you want to achieve another purpose, such as CNC and consolidation, or are you going to increase the general equalization formula? Because if you don't, and you have kind of a loose criteria for why those districts get it, it's going to become a political game. And then people are going to say, well, how come some district got it and some district didn't? And you're going to spend a lot of time hearing from districts like Wells about why they should be helped. Because they need help. They're here. I don't think anybody will deny it. The question is, how should the state do that? And so I would weigh that carefully. And finally, to focus only on equalization factors and thresholds will overlook the need to reform ANPC to separate LMD from ANPC and reform the formula to adjust for ANPC per pupil inflation. So whatever you do, whatever thresholds and tiers and you agree on, you can get the tax committee to agree on and debate with them over whose target this comes out of. When the day is done, I hope you will address the reforms in 3043. Because otherwise, it's just going to take a couple of years, and people are going to be back here asking you the same things all over again. And so those would be my comments. I would also point out to you all the different things that ANPC and referendum market value are used for. Now, I did say I would comment on the referendum market value approach on operating capital. Wipe ANPC out of your mind. Referendum market value is another tax base. Mm-hmm. It does not use the sales ratio. Therefore, it doesn't capture assessor variation district by district or county by county. But that was a decision made in operating referendums. And it has not moved the equalization factor. And so while you've increased the dollars per pupil that you will equalize, the relative effort, local and state, has not changed. And so districts that at one point it was about 50% state effort and 50% local effort are now moving to like 75% local effort and 25% state effort. And in fact, I'm meeting right after here to talk with a couple people about trying to put together a chart that would show you that. It's a more complex picture. It's not nearly as easy as the chart that's in here on ANPC. Because you've made so many changes over the years in referendum market value and that formula. But we're trying to show pictorially what's been happening. So that is, again, property tax relief that is very needed, because while you allow districts to go out and ask for more revenue, the burden has shifted to local taxpayers over the years from the state when the formula was first come in. I really appreciate your time and attention to this. And would be happy to answer any questions. There are other testifiers as well, Madam Chair, although I don't know exactly if I've used up all our time, but hopefully there's some others can come on up.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to, I don't think we have time for all those testifiers to come, but MREA supports this, the Farm Bureau supports 3043, does, Mr. Bradlandell would be happy to testify. And there may be others. I know the St. Paul School District certainly does support the sales ratio reform. But we probably need to hear from Representative Maury Lanny and from you also, Madam Chair. And when we have our big discussion about the comparison, what we want to do as far as policy changes, we're going to have to sit down and be very serious mm-hmm. about looking at all of these proposals. And I think there's a question maybe. No?
No. Madam Chair, I think the School Board Association has some position also on this, and I believe it's supported.
Of course they support it, but I didn't mean to say that because we know they do.
All right, we still have Representative Lanning, who also has a similar bill. And I think we should hear from him, and then I'd like to hear maybe a little bit more on the comparison of the two, exactly what they do, and the different costs involved. And yours is a little more complicated because of the sales ratio. So we'll maybe stick to just talking about the differences for now in the issue that they all deal with, which is the debt equalization. Representative Lanning, I will move House File 2662. and please move ahead before the committee for possible inclusion in maybe an omnibus education bill. We aren't exactly sure which direction this is going, that this is somewhat of a tax issue, and yet it's all education-related tax issues. So please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate very much the opportunity to appear before you on House File 2662. Something happened, unfortunately, to my expert testifier, Dr. Larry Nyblad, Superintendent of Morehead Schools. I'm a little concerned about what might have happened. He was supposed to have been here. But given the time constraint we have now, it's probably going to work out okay. I drafted House File 2662 out of a concern for property tax increases that we have suffered around the state. The latest numbers from revenue indicate that regarding school taxes, they have gone up 16.3%. And overall, we're looking at a 9.1%, and that includes the school tax as well. So the other taxes have not gone up. They've gone up less than 9.1%. In my home district, my school district, we've got property that suffered 33% increase in their school-related property taxes, 33%. We had a $2 million levy increase in the Morehead School District, and of that $2 million, $730,000 of that, 37% of it, was due to a loss of debt service equalization aid. In fact, if you go back to 04-05 versus 06-07, we have lost one half of our debt service equalization aid in our school district. And as you've already heard, this is due to several factors. We've had, unfortunately, still a drop in enrollment. Property values have continued to increase. We haven't experienced the same high percentage of increase that other parts of the state have, but nonetheless, significant increases. And neither the first or second tier of the debt service equalization formula has been adjusted since 2001. Now, statewide, I understand that we've had a 56% increase in property valuations. And so that has really contributed to this situation where those of us who are eligible for debt service equalization have lost huge amounts of money. Now, what my bill does basically is two things. It's not as comprehensive as the bill you just heard. I decided to keep it more simple and modest. The first thing it does is to increase the first tier from $3,200 to $5,000. In the case of my local school district, currently the state pays 17% of the debt service, and this would increasing it from $3,200 to $7,000, or I'm sorry, to $5,000, would raise the state paid portion to 27%. I'd like to point out that in 2003, we were at 33%. So the state aid was 33% of our debt service. Now it's 17. We lost half of debt service equalization. And so we're only bringing it back with this bill to 27%. We have requested the fiscal note, obviously, for this bill, and I've understand originally we were looking at about a $9.4 million cost. Now that's $6 million. That is the cost associated with this bill. What I'd like to say kind of in closing is, you know, we've had a good state policy by way of providing incentives to local districts to improve their school facilities. And we undertook a major improvement plan in our school district. Our voters approved a $64 million improvement. We virtually redid our schools. They were greatly in need of improvements. They had been neglected for many years. And, you know, we made a promise. The state made a promise that the state was going to be a partner in all of this. And now what we're seeing, of course, with debt service equalization, it's being eroded. That support is eroding. And so I really feel that we need to make an adjustment, make a change in the way we approach this debt service equalization issue. And with that, Madam Chair, I will conclude.
All right, thank you. You had somebody who was going to testify who has not come, correct?
Yes, unfortunately he's not able to be here, and I hope he's okay, because he was slated to be here.
Mm-hmm. Are there questions for Representative Lanning? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, maybe not specifically for Representative Lanning, but I know that there are three bills that have now been filed regarding reform on the effects of school levies on ag land. I think 1434 is Representative Broad's bill, and then there's a couple of others. Maybe Representative Demmer has
one. Representative Demmer has one, I believe.
I don't know if I can phrase this correctly, but what is the effect of those bills, if any, going to be on the debt equalization bills that we just heard? I mean, do they dovetail together somehow?
Representative Demmer, or do you? Would
that I'm just pulling that out, Madam Chair, to anybody that might be able to answer.
Mr. Strong, Mr. Hines. Come on, one of you guys, step up here.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be willing to give my characterization, but I don't think I would be simply. My bill, for example, is House File 1412, 13, and 14. Mine is House File 1412. Basically, what it does is it does like the the referendum market value type of a concept, where it removes ag land from the tax base. And so all that would do is shift around who's paying whatever burden we decide on. The burden as it is would stay the same for the total school district. Mine would just shift it from farmers/ag landowners over to residential and commercial. Representative Broad's are similar, except they do shift who that burden is going to. That's very general. I don't know enough to be more detailed than that, I guess, to be honest. But I would defer to Mr. Strom for maybe a better explanation.
Between the two of you gentlemen, Mr. Strom, why don't you go start? Mr. Hines,
Madam Chair, let me make a broad comment first, okay. And then maybe Mr. Hines wants to make some specific comments. But essentially, if we were to do something as simple as changing the tax class rate for ag property, if we lowered that or removed some of the ag land from taxation for school purposes, we'd lower the AMTC for school districts. So all of these bills would have essentially a higher cost in combination with that, because that property would... those school districts would be more property poor. If, as Representative Demmer was saying, we simply shifted the burden amongst taxpayers, then really these bills don't have, these equalization bills don't have much effect on a statewide basis. It's rather distributing that tax internally. So I think the big question is what intention one has with the ag property and how that would be handled. But anything that would reduce tax base under our current equalization scheme and under these bills would end up essentially generating additional equalization aid money for those districts.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Strong, then would I be correct in assuming that we should probably be considering the debt equalization bills and the ag reform bills sort of as a package, because they're going to affect one another, are they not?
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, yes, I think that's a real good idea. And if you took the United South Central District as an example, I think there are a whole bunch of issues run together there, one of which is they have a very large dependence on their agricultural tax base, which I think is a large reason for why their referendum's failing there. So any of these programs, as well as the bonding, are really all linked together. What you do in terms of composition of the tax base matters a lot in terms of what happens with school building projects.
Thank you.
Mr. Hines, were you going to add anything to that?
Madam Chair, I don't think I really add anything to that, and to reiterate, I think what Tim was saying, that for two of those three bills, the aid would be computed as if those bills weren't changing anything, because it was partly because it was too complicated to try to bring their definition of tax base into this equalization formula, where some districts might be on this program that the Demers bill envisioned and others wouldn't, so the equalization was left in place and it was more just distributing the burden. But we think one of the bills did actually affect the formula, so no real aid. Nothing else more to say.
Mr. Hines, is an education committee? we wouldn't necessarily deal with changing the values of ag land per se. We deal with equalization because it applies to school debt. How would we do this?
Madam Chair, I think in the past, sometimes when these issues have come up, they've definitely been something that both committees have been interested in, and I think proposals have come forth in the K-12 committee at first, have gone by a hearing in the tax committee, and ultimately been resolved. It's kind of an area where the tax committee you would think would want to have kind of ultimate jurisdiction, but in a lot of ways your committee cares more about the issues are more pertinent to the K-12 committee. So it is kind of hard to say which committee it really kind of belongs in, and I think both committees do have an interest in it.
Okay, other members with questions? There is no question that you should feel is a dumb question when we're talking about this.
All right.
No question.
I'm sorry, Representative Erickson, what were you trying to call
me? I think Superintendent Nolan had something to say.
Okay, you go ahead, and then we'll ask Representative Breiling to take her turn.
Fred Nolan, Foley, Superintendent. The thing I would add about the farm issue is in the current tax system, that would be treated as a limited market value of some kind if you reduce the valuation of farmland that's applied to debt. And that's why it would be important to separate the equalization formulas from the effect of limited market value, because it'll have a boomerang effect. Mm-hmm. The districts will actually have a lower sales ratio. They will then have a higher ANTC, get less aid, and that aid will be paid by those homeowners or those landowners who have properties that are closer to estimated market value than further away. So just be careful what you do in terms of creating more limited market value. You don't separate out the equalization formulas from the effects of limited market value. And Steve Hines, I think, could explain that a little more. Is that true? I think
so. Hines, you wish to do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nolan, I think the proposals we're talking about don't really affect the valuation of ag land per se. I think the proposals that were mentioned are affecting the tax capacity you'd apply to the rate to apply to the ag land, but not the valuation per se. There is a bill out there, another one of Representative Rod, that would suggest how you would value ag property that might get into the issue you're raising, but I think the debt bills we're talking about didn't. I haven't reviewed those recently, and I may be mistaken.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Nolan.
He is correct. The class rate is different from the valuation issue. And if you simply reduce the class rate on ag land, and that's all you did, that in itself wouldn't decrease the sales ratio. But as the ag land increases in valuation rapidly, the districts, as you see on the list that we presented to you, there's many districts there with low sales ratios that have a lot of ag land, in part because that's where a lot of property inflation is going on.
All right, Representative Grading, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're out of time, so I'm not going to ask any questions. But I'm glad that Mr. Hines is here. And I think that when we deal with some of these issues, it would be really a good idea if occasionally the Ed Finance people and the Tax Committee people, not just the staff but the legislators, would work together and meet together. Because I get very tired of all this equity funding, which is needed, being counted against the funding for classrooms. You know, to me, the equity funding is, I know Mr. Strom keeps saying it has to be part of our formulas, but it seems to me that when it just is property tax relief and it doesn't count for money for classrooms, and then people keep saying, what do you do with all this money for classrooms? But it really isn't money for classrooms. It's money for equalized property taxes. It seems like we're on a downward slide for the classroom dollars that I know Representative Funzian is trying to work on.
Without which some of that equalization, there will be no classrooms. So from the sound of things here today. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a member of the Tax Committee, I think this discussion is very helpful, and I agree that we ought to have some more joint discussions about these particular issues. I just want to say in closing, I failed to underscore the fact that my bill also indexes the debt equalization as property values increase in the future. And so I think that's another very important provision here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. We do have some minutes to approve, and these are from last Thursday.
So
yeah, they're excellent minutes.
I'd look at
them. The minutes have been moved. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Good. Opposed? But nobody wants to stay long enough to approve. All right. Meeting is adjourned. We'll be back here again tomorrow. And in the meantime, see what you can learn about debt equalization.